The following is a presentation of Remnant.
Hey, this is Jeremiah from Remnant Church. You know, we want you to be encouraged and filled with hope through your experience as you listen in. This life can be complicated, even confusing, but it's our hope that you catch a glimpse of God's unconditional love for you and His purpose for your life. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to a message from Pastor Jeremiah Vick.
Good morning. I already said that once, but I give you another chance to redeem yourself. And I'm excited. It's December. It just seems like it was November last week or something. It's crazy. December is my favorite month of the year, pretty much. One of the main reasons is it's pretty much a guarantee that it's going to be cold in December, right? Does anybody just like freeze out in their house, not turn the heater on, see how long they can go, how much money they can save? Anybody do that? You're all like, unfortunately, yes. Thanks. I ate one of Debbie's cookies right before I came up here, and then I was like, okay, Jerry's doing announcements, so I have a chance to go back and get some water. But no, it's lodged in my throat. There it goes. Nice. That's good. You know that feeling when you swallow something finally that's been stuck in your throat? It goes down. It's so good. Anyways, I was saying I love December because of the coldness. I remember one of the first years that Debbie and I decided we were going to try to really save some money, and we said, okay, we're going to not turn our heater on until it gets just absolutely unbearable. This is obviously before we had Josiah, so, you know, we could torture ourselves like that. And so we just, like, would bundle up in our bed. We would get, you know, extra blankets and everything and just see how, and then finally it just got so cold, we're like, no, we've got to turn the heater on. And I remember, I don't know if it was the same winter, but there was one winter where our heater went out. And I think it was like one of the coldest times, that times, you know, when the pipes were breaking and all that stuff. And the one time we actually made our bed right in front of the fireplace. It, you know, it was romantic and all, but that wasn't the real purpose. The purpose was to stay alive, you know. We wanted to survive till the morning time. And so anyway, it was, I think of all my winter experiences, and they're all good. Remember as a kid, my parents taking us up to the snow. And they did it pretty regularly so that we, you know, would get a chance to actually see that other parts of the world experience beautiful things. And so we would go to enjoy the snow, build snowmen, throw snowballs at each other, get in trouble, come back down all, you know, bruised up from the snow. But so much fun. And Christmas, my absolute favorite time of the year because, you know, I love the gifts. I love the lights. I love everything that is Christmas. Okay, and I know some people say, oh, you know, it distracts from the true meaning of Christmas, but I don't know. To me, I look forward so much to this time of year because of a lot of the things that we celebrate and the traditions that we have. And so, you know, I don't feel that it detracts in any way from the real reason. Every Christmas, my family would gather together, and my dad would read the Christmas story. And we had heard it so many times that we, like, had it memorized, but as Dad would read it, it was like, if that didn't happen, then it's like Christmas wouldn't happen. Do you have traditions like that? Things that happen in your home that if it didn't happen, it's like Christmas would not be the same. My family always celebrated Christmas big. And so as we approach Christmas, maybe in your mind, there's some things that you never really thought about the first Christmas. And that's actually what we're going to be talking about this morning, about the first Christmas. And the title is actually, or the myth that we're going to be busting this morning, is the first Christmas did not go as planned. The first Christmas did not go as planned. Okay, I've been on bad family vacations before. Has anybody been on a family vacation where it's just like, no, this... one time we drove up with Debbie's family up to Oregon. This was not a bad family vacation, but it was really funny because it was like my wife was with her two brothers, and she was instantly transformed back, you know, to the day and time when she used to fight with her brothers and wrestle with them and beat them off. And so it was kind of entertaining to have everybody all in an enclosed space driving up. I think we were in a minivan driving all the way up to Oregon. And that was a fun family vacation. I remember other times where, as a kid, we're headed up to Santa Barbara on vacation, and the wheel came off our station wagon. I mean, the entire wheel. It wasn't just like a flat tire. It was like the entire wheel just, I mean, I remember as a kid sitting by the window, you know, and I was especially happy because I got a window seat. Big family, you know, station wagon, you don't always get the window seat. So I'm sitting there, and I actually feel the car just like drop and hit the highway, and I see our tire, our wheel. I could see it just bouncing. I'm like, what is going on? We have no wheel. And so anyway, so we had to stop there for a while. And our station wagon, I was telling the kids on Thursday night, our family station wagon was already just, you know, a mystery in itself. It never had a dash, never had a dashboard in the entire time that I remember owning that vehicle. And so there was always wires, you know, sticking up. And I don't know, maybe when they were driving, they had to, like, put two wires together, turn this turn signal on or something. I don't know. But anyway, just a lot of memories attached to that. I remember times where we were lost, and I remember, you know, trying to figure out which direction to go. One particular time, well, I was lost, but my navigator was not lost. She was just asleep. Debbie and I were coming back from, where were we coming back from? Sacramento? And anyway, you know, north, south, east, west, come on. It's all the same to me. And so I was headed down the wrong way on the highway, and you know, it was like that scene, if you've seen Dumb and Dumber, it was like that scene where, you know, we'd driven halfway across the country the wrong direction or something. Oh, no. Debbie wakes up and she's like, where are we? We're in the middle of a cornfield. Where are the mountains? You went the wrong way. I'm like, I don't know what I did. Anyway, so I think about the first Christmas and I'm like, talk about, I don't know, talk about mishaps on a family vacation or an outing. And really what happened was it's kind of interesting because if you follow the sequence of events, you find that there was a lot of different things that went down that weren't necessarily ideal for a woman who's traveling pregnant. And so we're going to talk about those things this morning. Let's look at the passage, actually, that we're going to be looking at. First thing we want to talk about is travel and accommodations fiasco. The fiasco. Okay, it's Luke 2, 4 through 7 that we're going to be looking at. It says, so Joseph went from the Galilean town of Nazareth up to Bethlehem in Judah, David's town, for the census. As a descendant of David, he had to go there. So this is almost like a business trip because he wasn't like they wanted to leave when Mary was 9 months pregnant, but he went with Mary, his fiancée, who was pregnant. While they were there, the time came for her to give birth. She gave birth to a son, her firstborn. She wrapped him in a blanket and laid him in a manger because there was no room in the inn. I love reading about this story and reading like each account in the gospel so I get like the whole picture of what's going on. It seems so funny to me that Luke kind of squeezes everything into like three verses. And a lot of stuff that happens in those three verses that weren't necessarily ideal for travel. Okay? Some of those things, the first thing I can think of is traveling while pregnant, okay? That couldn't have been any fun for Mary. The second thing I think of is holiday traffic. Okay, it doesn't say in the Bible that Mary was on a donkey, but it does say that there was a census happening. And so everybody who had their roots in that town were headed into that town. So, I mean, the town was pretty much packed, okay? So family members were having family members come into town, and I'm sure the roads were crowded, and I'm sure it was just not the ideal travel conditions. Kind of reminds me of trying to travel on a holiday, stuck in traffic. Next thing, no vacancy. No vacancy. Man, I remember as a kid, we were driving late one night, and my parents decided they wanted to stop at a hotel, and I don't remember where exactly we were going, but I do remember the first time I'd ever heard the word vacancy was on that trip, because there was a sign that said no vacancy, and I remember my mom being very upset with my dad because of what the sign said, and I had no idea what was going on. But I could imagine what it was like for Mary and Joseph to be trying to find a place to stay, and there be no vacancy, no place available. Okay, another thing, emergency labor. Okay, the baby was coming, whether they were ready or not, and so something had to be done. And then lastly, no nursery supplies. If you read the story, you find out that they had to make do with what they had. And now, I've heard a lot of different accounts of the nativity, and I've seen a lot of nativity scenes, and they're so beautiful. You know, there's nice soft straw, and there's, you know, animals sitting around peeking in on the baby, all that kind of stuff. You know, it just, it has like a real picturesque feel to it, but I don't really know if it was like that. As a matter of fact, there's a good possibility, and this might destroy some of your Christmas, you know, first Christmas ideal, you know, the picture you have in your mind of what it was like. But there's a good chance that Mary and Joseph actually were staying with family rather than trying to find a place at a hotel. Okay? And the reason I say that is because the word for inn is only used one other place in the Bible, and it's used to describe the place where Jesus and his disciples met for the Last Supper, at the upper room. Okay? Upper room was usually a guest room in a house. And so it's a good possibility that Mary and Joseph, and maybe this makes the story worse, actually, there's a good possibility that they were staying with family and that the upper room was already taken. And so they had to actually share some space with the family animals. There's a good possibility that's what happened. Kind of changes the story a little bit. The Bible never mentions an innkeeper, although for some reason in Christmas pageants, the innkeeper's always like, you know, there. He's the guy that opens the doors like, there's no room here. And then closes the door again, right? And that guy never actually appears in the Bible. But he somehow comes up in all the stories. So there's a good possibility that the stable may have actually just been the downstairs area that was shared by the animals. And so the manger itself, I was reading a couple ideas on what the manger might have been. And I always pictured in my mind like a nice wood manger, you know, finely crafted, just, you know, looks kind of rustic and beautiful. But there's just a small chance that it might have just been like a ledge that stuck out from the wall, and it was just a place where they had placed the hay to feed the animals. And so there are many different possibilities as far as what the original nativity looked like, but I think we can safely say it was not ideal. I mean, if Mary and Joseph had to plan this thing out, I'm pretty sure it would not have happened that way. But it did happen that way, and I believe it happened that way for a reason. I think that whether it was because family had taken the upper room or whether because they were looking for a place to stay and there was just no space available, I think that the bottom line is that someone told Jesus, basically, I'm sorry, there's no room for you here. And it's interesting to me that this rejection was sort of characteristic of how people treated Jesus throughout his entire life. As a matter of fact, look at this passage in Luke chapter 9. A guy, and a teacher of the law, actually comes to Jesus and asks him a question. It says in Luke 9, 57 through 58, as they were walking along, someone said to Jesus, I will follow you wherever you go. But Jesus replied, foxes have dens to live in, and birds have nests, but the Son of Man has no place even to lay his head. And here, in one sentence, Jesus describes what it was like to be him as he was ministering to people. He was traveling. He oftentimes, you know, they didn't have plans as to where they were going to be staying. Obviously, Jesus had a plan because he's God. But understand that when this guy came and asked Jesus or said to Jesus, hey, I want to follow after you, Jesus was like, I don't really know if you want to do that. Are you prepared to be homeless? Are you prepared to be someone who spends a lot of time on the road, who maybe doesn't have a bed to sleep in? Is that something you're prepared to do? So my thought is this, that there's a reason, there has to be a reason that the Bible gives us so much detail about the fact that Jesus experienced this kind of rejection, this whole no vacancy, no room here idea. And I think it's this. I think the homelessness of Jesus reminds us that this life is not about being comfortable. This life is not about being comfortable. You know, we get so spoiled and we kind of expect to have things our way. And it's almost like the world owes us something. When the reality is, God is telling us, you know, this world's not your home. And look at the life that Jesus led. And tell me that was a life of comfort. And a life of maybe the security and safety that we picture of having a place to stay. Look what it says in John 1, 10 through 12. Kind of continuing with this whole idea of no room here. It says he came into the very world he created, but the world didn't recognize him. He came to his own people, and even they rejected him. But to all who believed him and accepted him, he gave the right to become the children of God. He came to his own people, and even they rejected him. I was reading that, and the first thing that popped into my mind was the scenario that possibly Joseph and Mary's family had said, you know what, guys, we're all full up. You're going to have to be downstairs with the animals. And I thought, wow, even his own people rejected him. And, of course, it's talking about the people that refused to believe that he was a Messiah. But understand that this life that Jesus lived as an example before us, and I believe that there's no detail in the Bible that's there by accident. I don't think God wrote something and said, oh, man, I did not mean to put that in there. I was just way too much TMI, you know. I don't believe that happened. I believe that everything that God has put in his word is there for a reason. And I think that the glaring truth here is that Jesus wants us to understand that this world is not our home. See, the world's rejection of Jesus only magnifies his acceptance of us. The world's rejection of Jesus simply magnifies the fact that Jesus welcomes us and accepts us with open arms. I mean, it's in a striking contrast to the way Jesus was treated here on earth, the way he treats us with open arms. You're never going to find the no vacancy sign when Jesus welcomes you. Well, let's get back to that night, the first Christmas. Maybe not even necessarily that night. Well, first let me ask you this question. Is there room in your heart for Jesus? Is there room in your heart for Jesus? That's the question that you have to ask yourself when you consider the fact that Jesus himself accepts us so willingly, and yet many times we choose to push him away. We choose to hang the no vacancy sign. And then the next question is, are you willing to give up the at-home feeling to follow him? I'm pretty sure this guy that came to Jesus and said, hey, I'm ready to follow you, when Jesus announced what it was going to actually be like, maybe he had some second thoughts about it. Are you willing to give up that at-home feeling to follow after Jesus? Check out what happens next, or the next detail of this first Christmas. The belated birthday party. I say the belated birthday party because when I was about, I don't know, 10 years old, and my dad told us that the wise men were probably actually not there in the manger with the family, that kind of ruined everything for me. I was like, man, as a matter of fact, I was so upset by that, I went over to our nativity scene, and I took the wise men out, and I put them on a different shelf. I'm like, you know what, you guys? You're out of the picture. You weren't even invited to the party yet. The belated birthday party. Check it out, what it says. Matthew chapter 2. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem, village, Judah territory, this was during Herod's kingship. A band of scholars arrived in Jerusalem from the east. This is the wise men, or the magi. They asked around, where can we find and pay homage to the newborn king of the Jews? We observed a star in the eastern sky that signaled his birth. We're on pilgrimage to worship him. Pilgrimage signifying that these guys had been traveling for quite some time. Obviously pretty long. You'll hear in just a moment. Verses 9 through 10, instructed by the king, they set off. Then the star appeared again, the same star they had seen in the eastern skies. It led them on until it hovered over the place of the child. They could hardly contain themselves. They were in the right place. They had arrived at the right time. I love how that part of the story says they had arrived at the right time. And I'm thinking about this. Okay, if you know the story, the wise men came to King Herod and said, hey, we're here to worship the new king. And King Herod's like, wait a second here. I didn't hear about no new king. What's going on? And they're like, oh yeah, well, it's you know, it's in prophecy. I mean, we saw the star. You know, the Messiah's here. They're, you know, filling him in all this stuff. And he's like, interesting. And so then, if you guys know what happened, he begins to command that every child that is 2-year-old and under, that's a Hebrew child, would be killed because they wanted to get rid of him. They wanted to find who this king is and get rid of him. And so there's a good possibility that it's around 2 years after Jesus was born. As a matter of fact, this story takes place after Jesus had made a couple different trips down to the temple and had been blessed by the people there. And so we find that the wise men truly are late to the party. But I love how it says here, they were in the right place at the right time. It was all in God's timing. And I'm pretty sure that what they had to bring was also perfect timing for the family. It says in verse 11, they entered the house, and they saw the child in the arms of Mary, his mother. Overcome, they kneeled and worshipped him. Then they opened their luggage and presented gifts, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Okay, so you read this the first time, and maybe the first time you heard the story, you're like, man, I'll keep the bling bling, but I don't know about the perfume and the medicine. I'm not really down with, I mean, that's, you know, it's like the people that come to the birthday party, and they bring the sheets, you know? You know, oh, bed sheets, thanks. You know, or is your little kid, socks, thanks, Grandma. You know, force a smile. But actually, these gifts were very valuable. And they said that the value was several thousand dollars in that day of the gifts that they had brought Jesus. And so you could imagine for the family that it was a pretty welcome time when they presented these gifts. So what can we learn? I mean, we know the story of the wise men, but what is God trying to tell us through the story of the wise men? I think the first thing is this. Even though the journey was long, seeking the Savior was worth the trip. I mean, you saw the reaction of the wise men when they came upon Jesus, when they had finally arrived at their destination. I mean, they get into town and they say, we're on a pilgrimage. We've been traveling a long time. And this is what we've been waiting for. It was all worth it. I love this verse in Proverbs chapter 8, verse 17. God says, I love those who love me, and those who seek me find me. And this is a truth that keeps appearing throughout Scripture. If you seek out Jesus, you'll find him. If your heart is truly searching for him, you'll find him. And I think the story of the wise men is a beautiful picture of that. It's a beautiful picture of even the journey that each one of us take in our lives in search of the Savior. And then we reach that moment in our lives where we find out about Jesus and we find out the forgiveness that he offers. I mean, our reaction is the same as the wise men. We're overjoyed. We're overwhelmed. Hebrews 11, verse 6 says, it's impossible to please God without faith. Anyone who wants to come to him must believe that God exists and that he rewards those who sincerely seek him. Another thing I notice about the wise men, they were ecstatic just knowing that they were drawing closer to him. I mean, it says as they were drawing closer, they were getting excited. Do you get excited about drawing close to Jesus? The closer you get to Jesus, do you experience more joy? At the prospect of spending time with him, do you get excited about that? I think the wise men set a great example for us. The response that we should have as we are drawing close to Jesus, as our desire to draw close to Jesus increases, our joy exponentially increases. I've read Philippians 4:4 a dozen times or 100 times probably, but I just noticed verse 5 the other day. It says, rejoice in the Lord always, and I will say it again, rejoice. Let your gentleness be evident to all. The Lord is near. The Lord is near. You know, I don't think it's a mistake that when Paul talks about the joy, he also talks about the presence of God. There's something about being in the presence of God that fills your heart with joy. And if you've never experienced that joy, And the invitation is open to you. And remember what I said, there's never a no vacancy sign. The invitation is extended to all of us. Another thing I notice about the wise men, they worship Jesus through giving. They worship Jesus through giving. I mean, these guys traveled a long way, and they were packing gifts. They opened up their luggage, and there was the gifts that they had brought to Jesus. And it was an act of worship. It wasn't just because the birthday party. It wasn't like, oh, Jesus, I feel bad. We're 2 years late to your birthday party. Now, we bought some expensive stuff for you. No. They were worshiping by giving. How many times have you worshiped God by giving? And I'm not just talking about, you know, whatever's left over, but giving in such a way where you're giving significantly to God, whether it's your time, whether it's your the talents that you have, whether it's your money, whatever it is. How often do you give to God as an act of worship? We've talked about that before. And I believe the wise men set an incredible example of what it is to truly worship God, to come to God giving. Romans 12:1, great verse, and I encourage you to memorize it. It's one of my favorites. It says, I plead with you to give your bodies to God because of all he has done for you. Let them be a living and holy sacrifice, the kind he will find acceptable. This is truly the way to worship him. You know what this verse is talking about? It's talking about giving yourself as a gift to God. It's about surrendering control of your life to God, presenting your life to God as a sacrifice, as an offering to him. And what does it describe it as? An act of worship. We too can worship God in the same way that the wise men did, by giving to him. So the question, are you willing to seek God even if the journey seems long? Even if the road is a little bit rough, are you still willing to stick with it and continue on that journey? I was talking to someone this week, and they're really struggling with this journey. The road is kind of rough for them, and the distractions are many. Do you find yourself in that place where you're going along that journey, and you're just like, man, this is tough. It's tough following after Jesus. It's tough trying to live my life to honor him. Guys, he's worth it. Jesus is worth every bit of it. Just like these wise men said, we were on a long pilgrimage, but it was worth every bit of it to be in the presence of Jesus. And secondly, are you ready to worship him by giving of yourself? Don't just make that journey. Don't just strive to be close to God, but give God everything that you have. If you truly want to bless God this Christmas, offer yourself to him. I mean, Jesus gave us the ultimate gift when he gave his very life for us. I think that if we would return that favor, we would give all of ourselves to him. And really, that's what God requires. If you read anywhere in God's word where Jesus talks about discipleship and what it's like to be a follower of Jesus, he says, give up everything and follow after me. A young ruler came to Jesus, and this guy was rich. And he said, Master, what do I need to do to get into heaven? In other words, what is it that I need to do to be with you? And Jesus said, you need to go sell all your junk. You need to get rid of everything and then come back. And I don't think that that's a standard Jesus puts on everybody, but I believe he looked right into the heart of that guy, and he said, you know what? The thing that's keeping you from following me is the stuff that you have. Bible says that he walked away sad. He walked away disappointed because he knew he couldn't give those things up. Are you willing to make the journey to see Jesus, and are you willing to worship him by giving of yourself? I think that's the glaring truth we find from looking at the wise men in the Christmas story. The third thing I want to talk to you about the first Christmas is the bad PR committee. Public relations. Yeah. Okay. If Mary and Joseph had a choice to choose who would be the people who would herald the coming of the Messiah, the King of the heavens and the earth is born, who are we going to pick to go out and tell that news to? I mean, who is the person that's the most reliable source that we could send out to tell the entire world that Jesus is born? Well, let's see who they picked. See who God picked. Luke 2, 15 through 20. When the angels had returned to heaven, the shepherds said to each other, "Let's go to Bethlehem. Let's see this thing that has happened, which the Lord has told us about." So, shepherds. Shepherds were not like the most popular, best dressed, most prestigious guys in the community.
They didn't smell the best.
They did not smell good either. I mean, these are the guys that just spent all the time in the field with the animals. I mean, these weren't the social people. These weren't the people that, you know, that had the street knowledge, that were around town, that people looked up to and respected. I mean, maybe these guys had never even been into town. You know, these guys were like the hicks. They lived up in the hills. And when they came into town, people might have been like, uh-oh, here comes the shepherds. You know, those guys with the funny accents, the hillbillies. These are the people that God chose. You know, it boggles my mind. It really, truly does. A group of guys taking care of the sheep on a mountainside. That's who God chooses to come to. I mean, in all the world, the people that, you know, God could have come to someone in the palace at the time and said, hey, sent an angel that said, hey, the new king has arrived. And imagine the news spreading from the central place of information in the city. Imagine how impactful that could have been on the community. But no, the shepherds. And I don't even know if everybody believes stuff that shepherds say. I don't, you know, David was a shepherd. And you remember the stories that David told Saul? He was like, hey, I've killed a lion, I've killed a bear. And I believe that David did all that, but I'm sure Saul was listening to him being like, yeah, dude, you killed a lion, you killed a bear, you killed a, yeah, okay, whatever, dude. I know what you do. You sit up on the mountainside, you eat your, you know, block of cheese, and you watch the sheep. That's what you do. Man, talk about bad PR. But check out the response. The shepherds say to each other, let's go to Bethlehem. Let's see this thing that's happened, which the Lord has told us about. So they hurried to the village and found Mary and Joseph, and there was the baby lying in the manger. After seeing him, the shepherds told everyone what had happened and what the angel had said to them about this child. And all who heard the shepherd's story were astonished. But Mary kept all these things in her heart and thought about them often. The shepherds went back to their flocks, glorifying and praising God for all they had heard and seen. It was just as the angel had told them. I can't imagine being the shepherds and having to go back to work after that. They're like, we were visited by angels. The sky was lit up. They gave us the greatest news in the world. And tomorrow's Monday. I had to go back to work. And but I think if there's any truth we could take from the story of the shepherds in the Christmas story, it would be this. They weren't content just hearing about it. They wanted to see it for themselves. You know, I mean, the angels gave them all the details and told them everything that was, what it was like, even told them where it was happening. And these guys were like, you know what? I'm not satisfied with just hearing about this. I'm going to go see it for myself. I'm actually going to go down there and check it out. Look what they say in Luke 2:15. Let's see this thing that has happened, which the Lord has told us about. How often do you have that attitude? You hear that God is moving and that God is working in someone's life or in some at some place. How often do you say, you know what? I don't want to just hear about it. I want to be a part of it. I want to go and I want to experience it for myself. Do you look for where God is moving and where God is active and say, yeah, I want to join up with that. I want to be a part of that. I want to be a part of what God is doing. These guys weren't happy with just hearing about it. They had to go see what happened. And then I think another truth we can take away from this is they didn't keep it to themselves. The news was too important not to share. They heard this news and they told everybody. And I love how, you know, I said earlier, and I was kind of joking, said a little facetiously about the shepherds being bad PR, but the fact is these guys told a lot of people about what had happened, and it says that everybody that heard the story was astonished. obviously they had some weight with the truth that they were telling the people they talked to. And I believe with all my heart, the shepherds were talking to the other shepherds and the common people, the people that they related to, the people that knew them, that trusted them, knew they could take them at their word. And I think it's amazing that God chose to use the most commonplace people to give the greatest news that had ever been told. Isn't that what God does with us? He takes just the common, ordinary people like us and says, hey, I have the greatest news you've ever heard. And it's not a secret. I want you to tell everybody. Mark 16:15 says, this is Jesus' own words. He said to them, go into all the world and proclaim the gospel to the whole creation. To the whole creation. I read that verse and I was thinking to myself, and actually I decided I was going to look up the word creation just to see if this is true, but he wasn't just describing people, but all of creation, everything that God made and created, that's who we're supposed to give the news to. I don't know, maybe you need to go in your backyard and tell the fence about it. You know, in other words, this news is so great, it has to be shared with anybody and everybody and anything and everything. It's the greatest news in the world, and it was entrusted to us, common, ordinary people. Imagine how honored those shepherds felt that day. Wow, we're just shepherds. We're just minding our own business. And God chose to send his messengers, the angels, to us. I mean, what a spectacular fireworks show. And these guys, I mean, that was the highlight of their lives. And is that moment when you heard the news of Jesus the highlight of your life? The moment when you heard the good news? Is that the pinnacle of your life? And has everything that's happened since that been an effort to spread that news? And if it's not, we need to take a lesson from the shepherds. We need to look at what the shepherds did and their response. And I think we need to have the same response. We need to go tell the entire world about what Jesus did for us. So the question is, are you ready to experience God for yourself? Not just live off the experience of others, not just go off of what you heard, but actually experience God for yourself. Follow after God in such a way that God gives you those incredible God experiences that you can't get anywhere else. And are you willing to take the greatest message to a world that's dying to hear it? I think if we were to look at the Christmas story, we would find that one of the greatest truths here is that the story should not be a secret. I think if we were to learn a lesson from the shepherds, the lesson would be, we've got some news to tell. You got to let people know. So the first Christmas story, I mean, when you look at it at first, you see all these things going wrong. I mean, you actually can picture in your mind Mary turning to Joseph and saying, can anything else go wrong on this trip? But understand that God had a perfect plan. I mean, there were no mistakes that happened. Everything happened for a reason. And I believe one of the reasons that things happened just the way they are is so that we could draw these truths out and so that our lives could be changed and our lives could be different because of the Christmas story. And I invite you this Christmas to explore all of what God has for you in this story. I mean, I just touched on a little bit of the story, and I believe that there's so much more that God wants to teach you and that God wants to show you about how he wants you to live this life in response to the greatest gift that was ever given us. So I believe we could say the first Christmas did not go as planned. It's pretty much busted. I think it went exactly as planned. And maybe by the world's standards, it wasn't ideal. But I believe by God's standards, it happened exactly the way it was supposed to. And I hope that the message in our hearts rings true to everybody we talk to at Christmas time and throughout the entire year. Because, I mean, these are timeless truths that are being taught to us by the Christmas story. And I hope that we don't...
You've been listening to a presentation of Remnant. For more information, visit us at remnantchurchonline.com.